All right, well, good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the last session of the last day of the last room of the convention center here.
I don't know who we pissed off, but
we're the last people standing. So, welcome, and my name is Liam O'Fallon, and I work with the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences in North Carolina. It's my pleasure to moderate the session today. I will beg your forgiveness up front. I have to leave and catch a flight, so I will introduce our three panelists here, stay for the first presentation, then you'll see me walk out. So it's not because I've given up on the, on the panelists here. So today's session, we'll be talking about applying frameworks for academic community partnerships. This was an idea that had come out of Christy Pettibone and Mike talking with our coworkers, our colleagues across the our community outreach and engagement corps, which is a network of community outreach and engagement experts across the country. And one of the things that we've been grappling with has been evaluating the type of work that they're doing. And so Christy has been working with several of the community outreach and engagement core leaders in developing a framework, and they will be talking about that today. We also have Wendy Cohen, who will be talking about training the next generation of community health practitioners through a new interdisciplinary undergraduate course. So really quickly, Christy Pettibone has more than 10 years' experience managing and conducting public health policy research and evaluation projects. I won't read her full bio. She's at the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, works down the hall with me. Kathleen Gray is the Associate Director of Outreach and Public Service at the University of North Carolina Institute for the Environment, and she directs the community engagement and research translation activities for two federally funded research centers in the UNC Gillings School of Public Health. And Wendy Cohen is the Associate Professor in Public Health Sciences at the University of Virginia. Her research includes projects to understand chronic disease and health disparities, the public impacts of the built environment, and cancer prevention and control. So this is going to be a really great session today. We'll have ample time for discussion at the end. So with that quick introduction, I'm going to turn the podium over to Christy Pettibone, who will be talking about a framework for academic partners supporting community change.
Thanks, Liam. All right. Well, thanks for making the trek all the way over here. So what I'm going to talk about today is a framework that we've been working on. As Liam said, it's been sort of being developed over the last couple of years. I'm going to give you a little bit about the background on sort of why we did it and some of the reasons, some of the rationale, and some of the challenges that our academic partners face. And I'm sure Kathleen will get into a few of those also. But the main goal of this presentation, we want to present the framework to you, but what we really want to do, and we save some time at the end for this, is to get your feedback, because we're really looking for this to be a practical tool that anybody really engaged in academic community partnerships and community change work should be able to use. So we've kind of developed it from the academic partner's perspective, because that's who we fund from the National Institute of Environmental Health Science. But I think as we go along, you'll see it should be applicable to other folks, and that's one of the questions we have for you. So as Liam mentioned, I'm an evaluator with the NIEHS, and I think he talked about this also. One of the ways that we fund research, one of the things that we really try and do is fund research that helps translate basic science findings into efforts to promote public health and prevent disease. And so one of the ways that we do this is by supporting these academic community partnerships in the community. The other thing is, about this. So I tried to do, I heard, you know, a long time ago, right, you know, make your slides interesting and have images up there and don't have so much text. And so I actually have handouts here. So most of the stuff that you're going to hear me talking about is summarized on this handout. So I don't know yet, thanks. And then my contact information is on there. So don't feel like you have to scribble furiously. So I think, you know, we're probably all working in community change, doing that kind of work. So I think we probably all have this understanding that there's ample evidence out there that tells us that these academic community partnerships are really helpful in affecting change and in bringing about change. But there's really limited literature or any concrete guidance on how to actually do it, how to support it and sustain it and evaluate it. Oops. So, as I'm sure many of you know, community change is messy. It's super messy, and it's sometimes figuratively, but sometimes actually literally. And then I almost actually changed this picture out for what I looked like after I tried to eat a beignet this morning, because that was really messy too. But anyway, our grantees who serve as these academic partners, they told us that they could really use a framework or a guide to help them, first of all, facilitate a more concrete discussion about the roles that the academic partners can play in this process, but then also to provide a way for them to actually demonstrate their contribution to the community change. So, as Liam said, a group of us got together over the course of several grantee meetings, lots of phone calls, to try and develop a framework that worked for us. Our group included the two academic partners, Katrina Korfmacher, who we'll actually hear about a little bit later in my presentation, and Kathleen Gray. And then we also had a community partner. And these folks have been doing this work for a really long time. And then I brought the evaluator perspective. And as we started off, we sort of faced what I dubbed the Goldilocks problem, in that there were lots of frameworks out there, but none of them were quite right. None of them fit exactly what we needed. So we pulled from several different theories and built a framework that we hope better showcases the various roles and opportunities that these academic community partnerships can play. So some of the frameworks or some of the theories that we worked from were community research change, or community change research, translational research, and community engaged research. So I want to talk a little bit about challenges. Oops, wait a minute. Oh, did I lose a picture? Oh, no, I just got it in the wrong order. So a little bit about challenges. So the children here, you can see they're playing at a playground right in front of an oil refinery in Texas. I'm sure that there are similar scenes right here in Louisiana. But these communities are, they face very well-documented challenges in sort of dealing with these environmental health problems. And in trying to work with the communities to address these types of challenges, our academic partners face their own set of challenges. And so I just want to go over those briefly so you have sort of an understanding of the kind of things that the academic partners face and why they were really looking for this framework. So the first thing is that there's lots of different strategies, I'm sure we all know this, about going about bringing about community change. So, I mean, you could develop an intervention, you could do policy, you can do enforcement of policies that are already there. And then there's different roles that each of these partners could actually play in the process. I think the biggest thing, and we were just talking about this, I was talking about this last night with a friend of mine, right? There's usually very little time to actually plan some of these partnerships. I mean, a lot of times you have to sort of, it's developing as things evolve. And there's not a lot of sort of pre-planning or thinking about who's going to do what and whose role is it. Usually that doesn't really happen unless, and I don't know about your experience, but it doesn't usually happen unless there's a grant that has to be written and somebody goes, oh, wait, who is doing what and what are we trying to do? And then I think related to this, one of the other challenges that we heard from our grantees is that, and I think we all know this, right, it takes a really long time to achieve some of these outcomes. If you're trying to get a policy put in place, if you're trying to, if we look back, it takes a long time to get that kind of stuff cleaned up and to get the right people together. And so it makes it very difficult when you've got that sort of long time frame to actually document progress and to document any kind of successes. So, let's see. So the goals of the framework, we hope to give academic partners a tool that helps them clarify their roles and really helps them look at opportunities that they might have to demonstrate where their contribution is, where they have achieved progress or success. And then we also want to look at strategies that they can use to document these successes and this progress for funders and for other stakeholders. In real-world applications, this can actually be really important when, we talked about it, if they need to document progress on an annual basis for some kind of funding agency where they have to submit an annual progress report, they need to be able to show something other than sort of the long-term outcome. And then it's, we got all kinds of new people coming in. and then it's also important when the change that you're looking to achieve, if you're trying to implement a policy, you might do all the right things, you might take all the right steps, and getting that policy passed is still, it might be beyond your control. The legislature might change the, you know, champion policy, so, you know, something might happen. There might not be the budget in the state or in the organization you're trying to change policy. So all kinds of things might be outside the scope of their ability to actually achieve any kind of success. So the intended audience is for the framework. We developed this with the academic partners in mind. And here you'll see Katrina Korfmacher. She's with the University of Rochester. But we also feel like it is probably relevant for community groups and other people who are working on this. And this is We Act for Environmental Justice, and they're a longstanding community partner with our Columbia University co-ed. And we'll hear a little bit more from Ogunaya in a little bit. She couldn't be here. She's on the schedule, but she couldn't be here today. But she videoed her response to a couple of our questions, so we'll hear from her in just a little bit. So there's a couple caveats I want to bring up before I actually show you the framework. So first, we envision the framework as a tool to help organize the messiness of community change work. The second thing is that we really envision the framework as more of a guide. I don't know why it is walking through like that, but as more of a guide and not necessarily a prescriptive strategy. And one way that I sort of like to describe this is we've got two maps here. I don't know, we're from North Carolina, but NIH is up in D.C. And so, right, we're not presenting this framework to say this is absolutely how you must get to community change, because there's lots of different ways to get to where you want to go. So we're not saying it's prescriptive or linear. So we'll see that in a little bit. And then we also recognize that there's not always an opportunity to plan in advance. And that's actually one of our discussion questions later on, is how can we maybe get folks to look at this tool for both planning, implementing, and evaluating. So with these caveats in mind, let's go ahead and take a look at the framework. So it takes into account the complex nature of community change, and we're hoping it helps identify the potential roles that the academic partners can play. And we highlight sort of all the different functions. And so, as I mentioned, this is not intended to be linear. What we're really trying to do is organize some of the common activities that our partners play in the community change process so that they can see what their roles might be and then figure out what their contribution is. So let's break things down just a little bit. So at the heart of community change is that academic community engagement. And so we wanted to reflect that in our framework and show that as really the hub of all of these activities. So next we have what I hope are fairly self-explanatory quadrants. And so we just sort of broke those down just to break it up a little bit. And so then what I want to do for the next couple slides is kind of walk you through using some examples from our grantees just to talk about what some of the components are within the framework. So in this first upper quadrant of initiating change, some of the common components that we heard from our grantees, from the folks we developed the framework with, and from looking at the research and some of these other theories that were out there, were identifying and framing the problems, asking questions to help inform the solutions, and then collecting and analyzing the information. So as an example, what we see here are our grantees at University of Southern California, and they're our academic partners in a project to address the goods movement in Los Angeles, and they've developed some relationships with the communities in the ports near LA and Long Beach over many, many years. and so I want to reinforce a little bit the non-linearity of this, right? These are their community partners, and they're out on the streets by the ports measuring truck traffic and measuring air quality. And with the data that they have from that, they were able to then go back and start to frame the problems of some of the air pollution and some of the traffic issues that they were dealing with and look at it and go, okay, these are what some of the problems are. And I think another important piece is that the academic partner in this, the University of Southern California, what they were able to bring to that was some of the really basic environmental health research to actually document what the impact of air pollution was on the health of the communities in these areas. And so so that's a little bit about that first quadrant. So they were able to sort of collect the information, use that to help inform what the problem actually was, and then they had lots of community discussions to start to figure out, all right, what are some potential options for us? So in the next quadrant, we have advancing solutions. And again, I'll use a different example just to walk through some of those. But we have developing a framework for change, raising awareness, building support, and then identifying very specific solutions. And so this is one of our other academic partners. It's University of Rochester. And so this is an example of them sort of doing raising awareness and trying to build support about lead poisoning prevention and then remediation strategies and what families could do to sort of minimize their risk. So again, though, in addition to raising awareness, this particular grantee, University of Rochester, so you know they used the scientific research that they had on the impacts of lead on human health to sort of to inform much of these strategies, and that was really important in helping the communities think about what were some of the things that they could do to start to address the problem. So those were some of the steps, and identifying alternative solutions. So when we talked to Katrina, a lot of the solutions they were able to come up with, I mean, some of it was just raising awareness. We'll see at the end, they actually started to identify, they had some interventions that they did, and then they came around, and we'll see that they've got some policy solutions they were able to implement. So the third quadrant is actually implementing change, and we've got assessing alternatives and actually selecting a strategy, promoting it, and then actually implementing change. And this particular example is from the University of Cincinnati and the Cincinnati Children's Hospital. And they were tackling the issue. This was again air pollution and children's health, but they took a little bit of a different tactic. They weren't around a port, and so one of the things, they have a really high asthma rate in Cincinnati, and so they looked at that and they said, all right, how can we really tackle this? And so they looked around the schools. That's where the kids spend most of their days. And they saw that there were sort of two, I guess, sources of air pollution there. You've got the carpool lane with parents pulling in and out. But then you've got the buses. And the buses sit there and they idle and they idle and they idle while the kids get on and off. And so they worked with, so that when they were sort of assessing the alternatives and selecting a strategy, they looked at those two different things. And the academic partner in that relationship, University of Cincinnati and the Cincinnati Children's Medical Hospital, were able to come in and say, look, that you know the pollution from these buses, it has much more of an impact on the kids' asthma rates and the instances of asthma sicknesses, sick days, than the carpool lanes. And so they said, let's tackle the buses first. And so promoting the solution and implementing the change, just some of the things they did, they came up with the signs and a little bit of publicity, but to really get at promoting the change and implementing that strategy, they worked with the bus drivers and they worked with the folks that had the contract for the buses and the bus drivers, and they actually got them to implement a policy that said there will be no idling. You will turn off your buses when you are at the at the schools, and they had to work with them. They had to figure out sort of what some of the issues were. But they have this picture right here is a picture of the bus drivers in a training class, sort of learning why it was okay to turn off the buses, why it didn't mess up the engines, why how they could get heat in Cincinnati while they were waiting for the kids to get on the buses and stuff. So the fourth quadrant is sustaining change. So I think this is one of the biggest challenges. We can do all the work that is needed to affect community change and to get things to happen, but then we need to be able to sustain that change, and whether that is through a policy or a budget line item or somehow making sure that change is institutionalized. So we sort of came up with this term, formalizing the change. So making sure that it is somehow sustainable, that it is going to carry on once the funding is gone or once the particular champion is maybe not in the picture anymore. And so this is just another example back to University of Rochester and their lead prevention campaign. And so based on their work with the communities, they were able to say, look, we really should be tackling this from a housing perspective and getting them to address the housing issues. And so they involved other partners and working with that. And they were able to provide the city with enough evidence to say we need an updated code, we need to revise the code. And so I think the example here of sort of sustaining it is that there were two things. One is they, if I'm remembering this correctly, I don't know if you remember more about this, but Katrina was talking about the fact that they had done all this work and then they had a change in their city leadership in the city council. And so they kind of had to go back and rebuild new relationships and ensure that this policy didn't get revised or removed. So that was a little bit of their sort of working to sustain it. But the disseminate and replicate change is this. They now have this policy available so that other cities can contact them and incorporate it into their own codes, and it sort of serves as a model policy. And the evaluating or amending, sort of looking at, is it actually working? So they, I think they actually have some studies in place where they're looking at the change in human health. So, you know, is this code actually working to reduce lead poisoning rates in the city? So those are that's the framework. I mean, that's kind of what we are looking at. I sometimes look at it and go, well, of course, these are the components, right? This is how we do our work. And so some of it seems fairly common sense to me. But we couldn't find anything that incorporated all of these components in any one place. And so we put this up here for you all to help us reflect on, help us look at, think about whether it would apply for your work and whether it would be a practical tool for you. One of the things that I mentioned, though, is that in addition to planning, using it for planning and implementation, I'm an evaluator. And so I really want to see people using this tool as an evaluation tool. And so in 2012, NIEHS, that's our National Institute of Environmental Health Science, we released an evaluation metrics manual that helps our grantees think about their work in terms of logic models and metrics and really measuring what they do. And this framework's really just an extension of that work. It's another tool that enables the communities to sort of systematically think about what they do and documenting their work. But many of the challenges that make community change work difficult and messy in the first place also make evaluating it really difficult. So I just to quickly refresh our memories, a couple of the challenges that come up in evaluating the work. We've got this issue of contribution versus attribution. And so I just want to, I know in our evaluation world, I think it's pretty clear, but when I was practicing this presentation, some folks were like, you might want to tease that out a little bit. So contribution versus attribution. Contribution is our work helped contribute to that. Something that we did helped change that. Whereas attribution is more, we specifically made this happen. It was us and us only. And you know, sitting here writing this, I was like, it's kind of like, I think most of us are probably old enough to remember this, but it's kind of like Al Gore saying he invented the internet, right? That's attribution. It's probably a little more correct to say that maybe Al Gore had some role in the internet coming about. And so that's a big challenge for our grantees, is sort of being able to figure out what they can claim as progress and as success. So another challenge is these changes in contextual factors. So the contextual factors are the things that are outside the scope of what the grantees can really work on. And that goes back to the University of Rochester example. And they had this policy in place, and then the leadership changed. And so they had to think about were they going to be able to sustain the policy? Was it going to be able to stay in place? There's all kinds of, that one of the big ones that comes up when you're talking about contextual factors are these natural disasters. So, you know, was there a massive flood? Was there a wildfire that, you know, sort of got something outside of somebody's control or caused people to change direction? So it's sort of, keeping in mind that there are things outside the control of the community. The fact that it can take a long time to achieve change and being able to document that. And then the fact that their role, the community partner, the academic partner's roles in this process are so vastly different. There's so many different roles they can play that there is no one metric that helps us understand the contribution of the partners in this process. So to help facilitate the use of the framework as a tool, we developed a bunch of questions that the academic partners could think about as they are working through this process of community change. And so these questions are designed to give partners ideas about more qualitative interim descriptions of what of how they can document their progress. And this is really important when they have to report on an annual basis, when it may take several years for them to actually document a final type of change. And so I think I'm getting close to being out of time, and I forgot to start my... Okay, yes. I think you can read through these, and I'll pull them up, but it's really, they are designed to be very qualitative, very narrative, and to get at these sort of short-term ways to measure progress and to talk about progress without just saying, we held 4 community meetings, and we had 300 people at those community meetings, and we distributed 20 brochures, you know, we distributed, you know, 300 brochures at 3 different meeting, at, you know, 3 different conferences or something like that. Right, those are helpful, but some of this narrative, descriptive type questions can really help, I think, it can help academic partners think about really what was their role in bringing about this community change. So let's see, just to look through, you know, what role did they play? How did they contribute to certain aspects? How did they help the community explore multiple solutions to the problem? So, and I see people trying to tell you, I didn't have room to include this on the one-page handout. I'm happy to email these to you. My email address is on there, so I'm happy to email these to you. You know, what information did they provide to decision makers to help inform any kind of decision that the decision makers were able to perform? So this is another challenge. Probably, I think most universities, our grantees are federal grantees. We're not actually allowed to advocate for a specific policy, but we are allowed to inform, and we're allowed to provide data to decision makers. And so, sort of looking at what data was provided, how was it provided, that kind of thing. So those are the questions. We've got a whole bunch of discussion questions, but I think what we want to do is wait till the end to come back around to these. So again, you know, the real point in me being here is to put this up here and for you guys to reflect on it a little bit. Kathleen is actually going to tell you a little bit about how they applied it retrospectively to look at a project, series of projects that they worked on, and really what we want to hear about, I think, in the discussion questions is we've applied it retrospectively in a couple case studies, and we want to hear about ideas for if there's a way to sort of think about using it more as a planning tool and then as an evaluation tool. So that's sort of the nature of a lot of these discussion questions. But let's hear from Kathleen and how their experience sort of applying the framework to their work.
Before we do that,
Oganaya
video?
So I have a video of Oganaya responding to some of these discussion questions, and so my thought was to play it as we, once we wrap up. Now, logistically, I'm not sure that might be you, but I think, one of the ways we were thinking about engaging you, but it sounds like you did it already, was, you know, if you're teaching a class that is working to do community change, you know, if one of our goals is to have people start to use a framework or tool like this in planning purposes, is it possible to teach them this when they're in school and you know, start to give them tools? I don't know if anybody else came in late. I think we have one more handout left, and if you want, I can, it has some notes from the first presentation and the discussion questions on it. And I don't know if I can talk and carry the conversation and scroll through, but we were sort of curious about how that would work for you. And then we want to hear from everybody else to see what you think of the framework. Did we miss something? Is there something there, that is sort of glaringly missing? Does it ring true? So I would say these are our discussion questions. I think, though, we are also happy to answer your questions if you had questions moving along. Any other? Any reflections or yeah? So I would say that's probably a very common experience, and I don't know, do you have, I think that's more Kathleen's background and expertise than mine.
So, I mean, there can be a lot of things going on, but two big ones jump to my mind. And one is just the difficult personality for which you need a good facilitator. And you also need to start a conversation by saying, okay, I'm going to facilitate today, and these are the ground rules, and if you're talking too much, I'm going to shut you up. And I mean, you know, so really, a skilled facilitator for the person who is just the dominant personality. But then, especially when you get to, my realm is environmental science and contamination in communities. So when you get to communities that have historically borne a disproportionate burden of the impacts of pollution, there are much larger issues, and that could be also what's going on, because I know some of your colleagues, and, you know, given where you are and what we experience with environmental justice communities in North Carolina, I mean, people bring up issues because they're asking for a remedy, and they haven't gotten a remedy. And in some cases, they've been working for decades asking for a remedy. So I was just part of a group in Research Triangle Park in North Carolina called the Research Triangle Environmental Health Collaborative, and they look at different issues each year and bring together government, community, academics. This year we were looking at exposure science and how to engage communities, and we had some of our longstanding environmental justice partners come and participate, and one of them said, you know, I'm here and this person aren't here because they don't think these forums are effective, and they're tired of coming with the expectation of action or solutions or assistance and not getting it. And I think if we, for a moment, if I take off my academic hat and say I am also a community resident, you know, member of many different communities, but if I'm in my community where we were dealing with the town on an issue where we weren't being heard, and that lasted for a couple of years, imagine if that were two decades. I mean, imagine if you represent one of the populations you represent has been disenfranchised and you have no trust in government or academia, or, you know. So I would just say it can be very frustrating when you're there, and we have different fundamental goals, right? Some of our community partners, like I said, they want action. They want their families to be safe, which is something we all want, but in their lives that may be much less possible or certain than it is for my family. You know what I mean? So I think you've asked a very complex question that has, one, the simple answer, who's the bore in the room who doesn't know that they're talking too much, that you just manage with facilitation skills, and the other is an age-old problem that is a thorn in our entire society's side, is how do we deal with discrimination, historic discrimination, and populations who bear a disproportionate burden of health or other outcomes. And it's not simple, so I guess that's a bit of an artful dodge, but I can imagine that's part of what's going on. Yeah, I'll follow up. I think that's an excellent point about finding equality among your partners was what I'm hearing you say. And so we may not have equality in terms of our income status, the positions we hold in the community, but we can, in our partnership, say, what are we each bringing? What will our roles be? What are your goals? What are my goals? Where's the place in the middle where we meet so that... And this is something we do, and now we didn't do this in the LEAD project, but always when we have a community-based organization as a partner, we set up an MOU. So it is a formal document where we lay out our role, your role, our expectations, and I think it's critical to your point about defining some equal space and shared goals.
So one of the things I wanted to do, too, is make sure that we play for you. So Ogunaya is, Newman, is with We Act for Environmental Justice up in Harlem and northern Manhattan. And so we asked her, so she has worked on this framework with us. She's been involved since almost the beginning. And she was supposed to present. Unfortunately, she couldn't be here. But we asked her to sort of video her response and sort of her perspective as a community partner in applying the framework to her work, as opposed to, you know, sort of hearing from Kathleen, who had the academic partner's perspective. So I'm going to see if I can play this. I need to skip it ahead because she spent a bit of time at the beginning laying out who she is, and let me see if I can get it.
Example of how we engage kind of like local residents and business owners around kind of like decreasing garbage along a really busy corridor. The thing that we really found that was really interesting about this is usually these frameworks that are developed, and especially the framework that was developed in, with this group and working with new community outreach and engagement cores, provides, I think, a roadmap and an opportunity for community organizations who kind of like operate in one sometimes silo area to be able to negotiate, talk with, and identify clear goals and objectives in moving forward and identifying really good partners in academic institutions. I think a lot of the work that we do at LEAC in terms of translating science for communities of color and low income, we often use different languages and we use different methods to be able to kind of convey information back to people that are impacted, but then also to take information that is a lot of times maybe in science-ese or maybe, done through a different process that we may not be familiar with, and we just need a foundation in which to be able to move forward. And we find that in order to use this type of framework, it also evens the playing field. So it doesn't establish any kind of different hierarchies in terms of power. It really allows people to step in and out of the process and gives them a really good leverage point and to understand their role. And with all of us kind of like clarifying and knowing our roles, it provides a really good framework in order for us to be effective and efficient at really making sure that we're impacting the things that we want to impact in terms of policy and practice, and also in terms of being able to recognize and use the skill sets that we have that we may be the strongest at to be able to provide people with what they need. And we think that this also, here at LEAC, really adds to making the process a lot more seamless and to also creating opportunities for us to be able to celebrate each other's strengths instead of, sometimes identifying the weaknesses and then kind of using those weaknesses to then drive ourselves apart. So I think that we really think that this has been effective. It's also been really helpful in kind of like thinking about how we're going to report information back to our funders, because that's how we are able to do a lot of this great work. And finally, it's really helpful in helping to really get us to be able to measure our impact, because we all know that we want to not just be creating change and talking about the change that we're creating, but actually having measurable results. And I think that this also provides a way to really talk about the results and the things that are in ways where sometimes it's hard to identify some of those intangibles. So you can look at kind of like policy outcomes, which sometimes take a long time to measure, health outcomes, which take an even longer time to measure, but also the anecdotal and kind of qualitative information that really comes from how you may be improving certain kind of like steps in people's lives, or, taking down and breaking down barriers and challenges that come up as we're trying to look at and really understand, in our case, where we have for environmental justice, community change directly related to environmental conditions. And we really believe that this leads to a really great engaged process of kind of like building healthy communities, which is our ultimate goal. Thank you so much. I hope that you all are having a great time in New Orleans. And I wish I could be there.
So I have to say, I had only actually listened to the first minute or so where I started it. I hadn't gotten all the way to the end, but I think that's kind of cool. It sounds like she actually sort of answers your question too, and sort of highlights some of the things that we've been talking about. So that is a nice bit of synergy there, I guess. So I don't know. Are there other comments that folks have on the framework? Are there, is this something that you think would be useful in your planning? Is there, yeah.
Right. Oh, do you have to involve them?
Do you have to do the whole wheel? I would say no, but you want to, right? I mean, so if you only get to part of it, some projects just, that is their natural life. There isn't that policy change that can happen. And in fact, when we started talking about this, we really did focus on policy examples that we each had, because they are typically long, sustained processes. But you might have something that's more discreet, and so sustainability might look different. The sustainability question might be, instead of how do I keep this change on the books, it might be how do I continue to maintain a relationship with this partner so that when the next project comes, So I guess I would say, yeah, you're looking at the whole wheel, but some projects may not take it into account in implementation, right? You agree with that?
Yeah, I think so. And then I think your other question was sort of funding opportunities for doing this kind of work. I think it depends on what your field is. I mean, a lot of my background is with health, public health. Obviously, I mean, that's why we're here. So, I mean, if that's what you're working on, then that's, I think I would be looking at probably CDC and some of their funding opportunities. and probably, I mean, you know, most of NIH funding, but I mean, you know, aside from some of the like research to action stuff, most of the NIH funding is going to be really for more hard science type research. But then looking at like, you know, maybe RWJ and those kind of things might be some other places to go for it. So, but one thing you said you were looking at, sort of looking at building capacity, you know, in your partnerships and things like that. And the thing I would say is, you know, if you want to check out the evaluation metrics manual, it's, if you come up here, I can give you the web address for it. It's available free online. You can download it. And it's broken into chapters. And it's got a chapter, if I can remember. It's been a couple years since we put it together. So the first chapter is on building partnerships. There's a chapter on capacity building. There's a chapter on leveraging. There's a chapter on, part of it was worker training. I don't remember if it was dissemination or what the general gist of that one was. But anyway, but within each of those chapters, we break it down and kind of give metrics. We sort of do a logic model for what the sort of common activities are and outcomes are in each of those categories. And then, we worked with our grantees. We worked with like 20 or 30 different grantees to just sort of brainstorm with them what would be some metrics that would help you sort of determine and document progress and success in each of these things. So it is somewhat geared towards environmental health, but I think that it is, they're general enough that it would be easy for somebody to take it and apply it to other areas of public health.
The other thing I'll say about funding is, since you're in a large metropolitan area, there may be private foundations
that are
issue-oriented, so depending on what issues your faculty are working on, you know, if it's environment or whichever specific health outcome, that can, they often are big supporters of community-engaged processes and might be easier to get in terms of the application process and the reporting process being less onerous, so don't overlook your private foundation.
I think one of the things that I was sort of struggling with just in putting this together was, you know, we sort of use, so I'm an evaluator, we've been using logic models, you know, ever since I got into the field almost 20 years ago, are we just sort of giving people one more thing like that? That's sort of a question that's been going around in my head is, you know, how does this framework sort of work with the logic modeling process in general? And I guess when I reflect on it and sort of think about it, I guess I see this framework as sort of being, I don't know, I've been in trainings where they sort of say, you know, go to that the 30,000 foot level and sort of come back up and look down. And so the logic model to me is that on the ground, really, you know, in there doing the work kind of thing, whereas this framework, I think, is a little more of that 30,000 foot level and sort of, you know, bringing it up a little bit and sort of looking at the process. I'll say as a whole, I think Kathleen referenced this, it's not likely that you're going to be able to think of everything that's going to happen, you know, but it at least sort of gives you some ideas about where some of the opportunities are.
I had a question for Wendy.
Yeah.
Can I do that?
Yeah.
I was just curious, what do you think the optimum number is, having done it with 77? It sounds like 77 was not manageable.
Well, that's such a good question. I think it actually in some ways is manageable with a little bit more support. Right, because, you know, with these learning teams, it actually makes it doable that they can, they did have these kind of significant experiences. I mean, our ultimate plan is to have this be like the entree into this work and then have a kind of more advanced, smaller seminar-type class that would follow it. But I think we could scale up if we had, we just, like, didn't have enough time in the day.
And I have a follow-up. All of the stuff you were talking about really happened in one semester? Wow.
Yeah.
And then my second question was, we just had the director of the CTS, the Clinical Translational Institute. I'm getting the letters wrong, I'm sure. But anyway, and one of their big things was, we're asking people to do this translational work, and yet when we train our science, so this is from the NIH perspective, and so we're, you know, these are scientists who go, you know, they train in biology, or they train in neurodevelopment, or they train in, you know, whatever their specialty is, and they don't really get training in any of these other areas, and they don't, and it is a very solitary and most times endeavor, and they get rewarded for their individual publications and their individual grants, and so they don't get training on working in interdisciplinary teams, and how do you even go network and find people who might be able to help you look at your problem, your wicked problem, with some different lenses, with some different perspectives. And so when I saw yours, I was like, I wonder if, and you guys have a medical school there, right? And so I'm sitting there thinking, what, you know, is this, are these the kind of classes that would be, you would be able to sort of develop for people in even maybe, you know, not just public health, but in some of the medical school or some of the science areas.
So and luckily, I mean, so we're actually in the School of Medicine. Mm-hmm. So we don't have a school of public health. We have a program of public health, but we're in the School of Medicine. And so we were excited because half of the students we think are pre-medish, you know, or maybe a third of them were pre-med. So I think they did get it.
Yeah, yeah.
Those students.
Right,
right.
Right.
But it'll never be in the medical school. I hate to be such a pessimist, but maybe someday.
Yeah. So, yeah.
I'm so excited to hear about this course. My name is Kathleen Roy. I'm from San Jose State University in California. And I've been involved in these kinds of courses for a while, but many years ago, we had a class of 15 that was able to go out and document who was when and left when the notebooks were new. So we had a few hackers who gave me notebooks, and they had their camera and their voice recorder.
Exactly. Right. Right. They're not jaded yet.
And they're also better with their technology. So it's a perfect deployment of resources and skills and academic progression. I think this is a real contribution.
Cool. So I should say our goal is that we have two manuscripts ready, one that describes the framework and one that sort of talks about the case study. So our goal is to submit those before the end of the year to I think we're submitting to Progress in Community Health Partnerships from Hopkins. Hopefully this will be out in the literature soon.
And can I ask, I was curious whether you had published anything about your work. Not yet. Do you have anything written up about it? Or?
I can share the syllabus.
Okay, great. Yeah.
So, I would say, if you are using it, so in putting together the presentation and hearing people's comments, even just in practicing my own presentation, I think there's some language in the framework that I might tweak just a little bit, and I want to go talk to my colleagues about some of that. I think there's a couple places where we have a little duplication, and so I want to maybe work out a little kinks now that I feel like I've talked about it enough and presented. So I would say, you're obviously more than welcome to use it. I would say if you do use it, though, maybe either come give me your name or come check in with us, and I'll happy to send you an updated one once we finalize. But thank you all for staying until the very bitter end. And if you have any more questions, I know Wendy has to leave, but I think Kathleen and I are here, so if you want to talk, we're happy to chat. Thank you. Yeah, you too. Bye.